Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we will be speaking to performance artist Kathleen Fontaine. I'd like now to welcome Stuart Ashman. He is the Cabinet Secretary of the Department of Cultural Affairs for the State of New Mexico. And I'd like to welcome Juan Delgado. He is the curator of the exhibition Confluencias Inside Arte Cubano Contemporáneo, which opens in Albuquerque at the National Hispanic Cultural Center this coming Sunday, September 13th. Welcome, gentlemen. Bienvenidos.
Gracias. Bienvenido. Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is an absolutely spectacular exhibition of Cuban art, something we haven't seen in the United States for a really long time.
Yes, this is really a earth-moving experience because there hasn't been an exhibit of this size in the United States since 1944, when there was a modern Cuban painters exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art.
So it's been a really long time, and it's actually been quite a story. Stuart, how did you find this exhibition? It's been traveling around the world, is that right?
It's been traveling around Mexico. It went to 8 cities in Mexico. It originated in the state of Michoacán in the city of Morelia. And Juan Delgado, Juanito, curated the exhibition in 2006. I had heard about the exhibition through the Foreign Affairs section of the Cuban Ministry of Culture, and when I was in Havana for the Havana Biennial last year, I was introduced to Juanito, and we started the discussion about an expanded version of that exhibit to bring to New Mexico.
And so among other things, getting art like this across the border is non-trivial because they're not used to bringing Cuban art or Cuban anything into the United States.
That's true. The embargo regulations allow for art, literature, and other informational material to come unrestricted for non-commercial purposes. But once they hear the word Cuba, they think it's forbidden. So we had to jump through some hurdles. I have to say that the U.S. Customs Office in Laredo was very helpful. They went by the book, but they were well-informed, and they guided us through the process. And 9 days later, the truck was liberated and came into the United States and arrived in Albuquerque on Friday at 11:30 a.m.
And so people will be doing very quick work to install this massive exhibition of art.
It's true. It's 100 pieces by over 40 artists. We've mounted a team from the National Hispanic Cultural Center and the Museum Resources Division of the Department of Cultural Affairs, and we expect about 6 or 7 people working full-time to get it open for the first preview, which is on Friday night. And then there's, of course, a gala on Saturday night, and as you mentioned, the public opening on Sunday at 2 p.m.
So let's talk to Juan Delgado, the curator, Juanito Delgado. Why is this show called Confluencias?
Bueno, se llama Confluencia porque es...
It's a new modality in the curatorial area, where the exhibit is not thematic. We wanted to give the idea where the final result will be good art. It doesn't matter the age, the modality. The important thing is that there be a nexus between the artists of various generations, where the good art from the Cuban artists comes together.
So you have artists ranging in age from their 20s through their 80s. How did you choose these artists?
Bueno, llevo dentro del arte cubano 30 años.
He's been involved with Cuban art for over 30 years. I had the great opportunity to meet the great masters of Cuban art, like René Portocarrero, Mariano Rodríguez,
Luis Martínez Pedro, Sandu Darié, entre otros.
Among others. And he always had very direct contact with the artists of Cuba. And this exhibit is a great dream of mine for many years, where he wanted to mix all of the greats in Cuban painting, from Sosa Bravo, all the greats of Cuban painting today.
So you have not only painters, but sculptures, mixed media installations, a lot of creativity bringing in traditional and contemporary genres.
Como bien te dije,
it's the best of Cuban art that's happening today. It's not only exhibited in Cuba, but in the many museums around the world, and also the most important galleries. We wanted to give everything that is happening in Cuba, despite all of the difficulties, all of the thematic differences that exist in the work, with a universal vision.
I think people in the United States don't know very much about Cuban art because we haven't seen very much. But there seems to be a lot of contact and influence between Cuban artists and art of the rest of the world.
Sí, mira, la mayoría de los artistas cubanos en esta exposición.
Yes, look, the majority of the Cuban artists in this exhibit, they are artists who studied in the major Cuban schools. They're very intellectual and a vast knowledge of what's happening around the world. And from that comes the idea that Cuban artists are universal. There's video installations, there's drawings, digital photography, contemporary sculpture, installations. That is to say that everything that is happening in the first world in the arts is also happening in Cuba.
There are some really incredible artists just in terms of draftsmanship, but they also bring to it such intensity of vision. Talk to us about some of the specific art.
Por ejemplo, hay dos artistas jóvenes que son dos hermanos.
For example, there are two brothers, two young artists, Iván and Joan Capote. Everything in their work has a philosophical feeling, intellectual, where they always do studies on their work from that point of view. For example, you'll see an installation by Juan Capote named Las Masas that is about a study, a research that he did on hearing, on the ear, ears from different people, where all the ears are directed towards the same point, and there's one that is opposing, as if, I don't care, I'm not interested in what's happening in that conversation.
Que va a estar opuesta, como que no me interesa lo que está pasando.
There is an artist who is called the Basquiat of Cuba.
Como bien tú dices,
as you say, American art, North American art, has had a great deal of influence in Cuba and in the entire world. All those names that he named, Jasper Johns, Basquiat, Robert Rauschenberg. Also, to a certain point, music. There's a lot of artists who have fed themselves on that language while at the same time creating their own language. There's some that, of course, have the influence of somebody like Basquiat, but also within that is what we call cubanía, like the artist Diago and the graffiti and his drawings and his brush strokes, and also another artist named Cacho who lives an intense life like the one that Basquiat lived.
There is an installation, or I guess sculpture, of a wooden bridge that, if you look over it, leads into a video of the New York skyline?
Exactamente.
Exactly. The exhibit opens with this great work by Abel Barroso. It deals with the bridge and globalization, where there's actually a sense of humor about everything that happens in these great cities of the world. And also, there's a bit about the hope, about the growing relationships, the bridge between the cultural relationships between Cuba and New York, that historically have always been very positive. If we do history, if we look at history, from the great exhibit in 1944, with all the great artists from Cuban music that have made their names in the United States, like Chano Pozo in jazz, Celia Cruz in salsa, Arturo Sandoval, Paquito de Rivera, greats from Cuban music, the greats of Cuban music who have passed through here. In painting, master Wilfredo Lam, where his masterpiece, The Jungle, is at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Historically, there have been a relationship with a cultural relationship of great importance.
There's a lot of humor in the exhibition, as well as serious, very serious themes, and sometimes a combination of the two. One of the artists brought a bunch of sheep into a gallery and photographed them.
Aparte del humor, hay un sentido también social, ¿no?
Besides the humor, there's a great social context that sometimes we are sheep and other times we're not, and the freedom of being a lamb, in a sense. The Cuban artist has always denounced the moment that he lives in from a philosophical point of view and intellectual point of view, with the hope of a better future.
There's quite a bit of self-portraiture in the exhibition as well.
Bueno, como bien tú dijiste al principio y hemos hablado,
as you said at the beginning and we've discussed, the exterior world always offers influence to the artist. And there are artists who have considered their work as part of themselves, like Jaime Garcia, René Peña. These are the artists who, in this exhibition, that deal with themselves, with their figure.
The young artists of Cuba have excellent training in Cuba. Once they're out, how do they make a living?
Bueno, existe una estructura de galerías.
There's a gallery structure in Cuba where there is a possibility from the commercial point of view. Collecting in Cuba is not one of its strengths. Because of the work that has gone outside of the borders, there are many great collectors from around the world that come to Cuba to buy work. And they go to the studios, and since they know each other, for example, recently Tate Modern from London and bought for their collection of Latin American art a great work of Cuban art. There's a great feeling right now that there's a sense of openness from the United States towards Cuban art, and there's a great feeling that will expand.
And that there will be people collecting Cuban art.
That's correct, yes. Sí.
Y entonces muchos museos del mundo y grandes coleccionistas van
many museums around the world and many collectors go to Cuba to buy these young artists, like Joan Capote, Iván Capote,
etc.
Now, one of the artists has a piece that's based on buying a piece of land on Mars, is that correct?
Ernesto
Leal is his name. Over the internet, he purchased a little piece of earth, a little piece of dirt from Mars. It's actually a lot.
So it's actually buying real estate on Mars.
Piece of land, yes, he bought a piece of real estate on Mars.
Yeah, but today.
And then he did an installation based on this piece of land that he had bought on the internet. And then he donated that piece of land to the cemetery, the historic cemetery of Colón, Necrópolis de Colón in Havana. And there you get a sense of the universality of Cuban art.
There is some influence that you see in some of the works of Afro-Cuban culture, Afro-Cuban religion.
Sí, mira, la religión nuestra afrocubana,
as you see, the Afro-Cuban religion is rich in color, in hues, in everything, in its own philosophy. Every Cuban artist must have, in some way, been influenced by this religion. Whether you study the Yoruban religion, and then, of course, there are some artists that distinguish themselves more in those lines than others. As, for example, the great master Wilfredo Lam, Manuel Bendive, shows it in his vision, where he honors the Afro-Cuban religions. Nature, man, all the interrelation that exists between man and nature. Santiago Lazábal, despite the fact that he is a painter and also a babalao,
which is a Cuban, which is a priest in that religion.
Sacerdote, sacerdote de Ifá.
He's a priest in the religion called Ifá. His work called Plasma is all about the philosophy of Ifá. Not from a naive point of view, but rather from an academic painter's point of view. Then you see the work of Tiago, where he deals with social themes of man, the circumstances that he lives with in Cuba, where there are more discussions of the problems of man and society.
There was a period in Russia and the Soviet Union where there was a real imperative that painters paint a kind of social realism for political purposes. This show is nothing like that. Did you have a period like that in Cuba?
Nunca dominó la influencia del realismo socialista.
Social realism, socialist realism never dominated Cuban art. There may have been some influence, but always the Cuban artist painted what he wanted. For example, in 1988 I was in London with Maestro Mendive, with a great English scholar. So I expected to see an exhibit of social realism, and I'm in front of a universal artist. Maybe the frontiers and the borders didn't allow for people to see the vision of Cuban art. For example, the great master Wilfredo Lam, he brought to Cuba the Salon de Mayo, a great exhibit. He brought it to Havana, and he brought the French to see Cuban art. From there, from that visit by the French, the universality of Cuban art was marked. And yes, there may have been some influence of the socialist realism at some point, but it really never dominated or marked, or there was a marked period of this kind of work in Cuba.
I've visited Cuba quite a number of times and have a deep love for especially Cuban music. And what it feels like to me, at least in the places that I visited, Havana and Matanzas, people identify very deeply with Cuban music. Every ordinary Cuban knows their Cuban music. Do they also identify with their painters?
La música cubana históricamente,
Cuban music historically has been the people's music, from even from the people of most modest means. In the case of visual arts, that's always said that the visual arts are an elitist art. In the last few years, with the massification of
massification,
how do you like that word?
Sí, no?
Sí, where culture reaches everyone.
Right.
The people, as such, identify many of the artists. Every 2 to 3 years, they do the Havana Biennial, where Havana gets filled with all of the art of the world, and paradoxically, all the exhibits are full of Cubans.
Right.
The people identify good art, video, painting, who are the famous artists who are not so good, etc. They know the works of Mendive, Diago, Favelo. In the last biennial, Favelo installed at the Fine Arts Museum in Havana 5 cockroaches, immense, they were 9 feet long, and people interacted with that language, with his language. Why the cockroach? There's a great knowledge from the people of Cuba of the art, of the Cuban art, in a very general sense.
And that's really been a conscious program of the government of Cuba, of the educational system of Cuba.
I believe so. And also the interest of the people in their constant interest in improving themselves.
There are some paintings, some artworks in this show that deal with the question of migration, which is always a question in Cuba, people leaving Cuba, settling in Miami. Do Cuban artists tend to stay in Cuba? Do they leave the country? A little bit of both?
In the 1980s, there was an exodus by artists, a great number of artists. In recent times, no. There's an opening in Cuba, and there's an opening by the world towards Cuba. Artists like to travel. They have that possibility, and they like to return. I believe that Rauschenberg lived in the United States, even though he went to the Venice Biennial. Picasso lived in Paris, but he always returned to Malaga. That is to say, the artist always returns to his origin. Many of the Cuban artists that have been in exile go to Cuba to nourish themselves in Cuba, despite any political differences.
Because that's where their roots are.
Exactamente.
Exactly. The light of Cuba, the color of Cuba, the people, that's what makes Cuban art. That's what Sting said when they were in Cuba. Cuba can live solely on its art. Even though it's a small island, we're an island of artists.
And that has been very much cultivated through the school system and then by the appreciation of the rest of the world, because everybody in the world knows Cuban music, and it's been extremely influential on musicians, for example, in the rest of the world.
Exactamente, la música cubana viene de historia.
Exactly, Cuban music comes from history, from the ancestral influences, from the Africans, with the Catholic influence of the Hispanic, and then in the 20th century, with the movement of the Cuban trova, the antique and the old trova, all the modalities of Cuban music, which has made us universal. Cuban music is danced around the world. And my greatest aspiration is that the painting also be in the entire world.
It seems like there is that there's tolerance of even political dissent in the art. Is that true?
Mira, como en todas partes del mundo, existe de todo.
Like in every parts of the world, everything exists. There's inequality, there's disagreements, there are artists who are not in agreement. In some way they express it. The important thing is that it's said. Within Cuban art, it's always been that painting has been at the vanguard, where artists have said, I like it or I don't like it, even though the system may not like it.
What are your plans for this show? It's going to be at the National Hispanic Cultural Center for a long time, is that right?
Yes, it's going to be there for 10 months.
10 months. What do you hope to do beyond that? Will it travel more in the United States?
Bueno, sería un gran sueño.
It would be a great dream for it to return to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, of course. I hope that the spirit of Wilfredo Lam and Rauschenberg should get united with Picasso's. And that they should help me so that it reaches MoMA. If it's not MoMA, in the big museums, the great museums in the United States, because it is a museum exhibition. And the people of the United States deserve it. The artists, the people deserve it. Where art goes beyond all borders.
I have to say that having only seen the images from the catalog and not yet having seen the exhibition, I can still concur that this is an absolutely stunning exhibition of the very highest quality. Stuart Ashman, tell us, why do you think it's important that people see this exhibition now in this era that we're living in?
Well, I think some of the things that Juanito expressed are important because there is a lot of misconception about daily life in Cuba, and I think that the artists really show that they are aware of everything that's happening in the world and are very much a part of everything that's happening in the world. And that's expressed through the art. So that alone would be eye-opening for the American public. Add to that the fact that these are world-class artists working in the latest technologies alongside with artists that are showing at some of the cutting-edge contemporary art museums in the United States and Europe. They're a player. They're in the major leagues with American and European artists, and I think that'll be a discovery for a lot of the public in the United States, not just the art-watching public, but the public at large.
Will we get to meet any of the artists who are in the exhibition here in New Mexico?
Hay interés.
There is interest of many artists in coming because of the importance of the exhibit. I hope that they can come. Ojalá is a good word. It comes from the Arabic, and it's, you know, with the help of everything, maybe it'll happen.
God willing.
God willing, yes. I hope so. I expect so, because I think the Cuban artists are very human artists that could live in any part of the world. Because of the way of thinking, because of their way of being, and I think, yes, that I am a door to this great world of art. God willing, the New York Philharmonic will be in Cuba in October. I hope Aretha Franklin, Roberta Flack, that other groups could from Cuba, could, like Van Van, La Charanga, could come here. Or a good idea would be to have a ship travel around the world with Cuban and American artists, where we could say our flag is music, art, which I think is the light which illuminates countries.
It's nice that the colors of the American flag and the colors of the Cuban flag are the same, and those are the colors of the catalog of this exhibition.
Sí, creo que es una forma de...
It's a form of bringing the two cultures closer together. The American culture has a lot of influence from its base in Afro-American culture. If we talk about American culture, we have to talk about blacks in America. In some way, as them, of them as Americans, because color doesn't exist. Only the only thing that exists is the human being. Also, in the Cuban culture, there's a lot of influence from the Afro-African culture. And we're only 90 miles away from each other. So this bridge that Abel Barroso speaks about in his work, God willing, we'll be able to see that bridge.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I want to thank you so much. Juan Delgado is the curator of the exhibition Confluencias Inside Arte Cubano Contemporáneo, and Stuart Ashman, who has been talking to us and very kindly translating, is the Cabinet Secretary of the Department of Cultural Affairs for the State of New Mexico. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you. Muchas gracias.
Y muchas gracias. Y antes de retirarme, quería agradecerle muchísimo con todo el cariño que me ha recibido en esta ciudad.
Before we leave, I'd like to tell you how much I appreciate all the warmth that this city has received me from Stuart, all the staff at the National Hispanic Cultural Center, Clara Podaca from the foundation, Esteban Rael Galvez, the director, Dr. Tay Mariana Nunn from the museum, down to the last worker in the museum. Give him my thanks in my name and in the name of all the artists from Cuba.
Dale las gracias de todo corazón. Mi nombre y de todos los artistas.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you, and convey our love to the artists of Cuba.
Igualmente, gracias.
And once again, the opening of the exhibit Confluencias Inside Arte Cubano Contemporáneo, Inside Contemporary Cuban Art, opens this Sunday, September 13th, from 2 to 4 in the afternoon at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque. We're going to go out now with some music by Los Van Van, music of Havana, Cuba.
Aquí
I'm very happy now to welcome performance artist Kathleen Fontaine. Her one-woman show, Learning to Stay, will be performed this weekend at the Rail Yard Performance Center, September 11th, 12th, and 13th at 8 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's an honor to be here.
So this is a very intense one-woman show about, I mean, I'm assuming it's completely autobiographical.
Completely autobiographical, yes.
About subjects ranging from earliest childhood to a period in your life where you were heavily into some very scary drugs.
True. The quick pitch is I just simply say to people, I'm a crack addict. I'm a recovering crack addict, and it's my story of hope and healing. But, yes, it does venture into early childhood sexual trauma without being at all graphic, and that's where the performance art piece really serves the piece. A lot of things are just suggested, and I don't need to go into over-the-top details. But it's intense on every level. Somebody summed it up. They're like, I felt every emotion I'd never felt in my life all in one hour, never mind one night.
Right. It's an hour-long performance. And I think when you are developing a show like that, I would think that the process of deciding what details to put in is a very tricky business.
It's a very tricky business. It took me a year to eke this show out of my body, to get it on paper. I've been working with my director, Susan Mealy, for almost 16 years now. We did sketch comedy in San Francisco and in Los Angeles together. We performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival doing sketch, again, a whole different thing. I moved here to Santa Fe from Los Angeles, where I'd also done stand-up comedy, and I thought I was done with performance. I came here for rehab, and I thought all that was just part of my past. But this story needed to be told. And I'm still scared that I'm doing it. I can't believe I'm doing it. This is the second run. I had a phenomenal feedback for the first run. A lot of enthusiasm for this one.
Where was the first run?
Same place.
Oh, okay.
Rail Yard. They've been amazing. It took me a year to get it out. I went to Baltimore, where Susan is from, to do rehearsals. We rehearsed at the center stage there, and I didn't have it fully on paper. I had outlines and parts and bits and pieces, and the way the show finally got written is she'd say, go in the other room, go in the actor's lounge, you have 40 minutes, write the second part, come back. I wrote it, we'd get up, move it, work it. She's like, okay, go write the third part, come back, same thing. So that's how it finally made it to paper. Through many tears, it's just been a laborious, it's been like a birth. I don't have any kids. Susan has four. She's like, I birthed my fifth child with your show.
it's stuff. I don't know if that's the right word, but at the beginning you put on, very simple costumes, no costumes, almost no props, just a few little things, and you put on these hefty garbage bags. I thought that's just a great metaphor for your own baggage, your own garbage. Externalizing
and
it.
The layers I think it's the beauty of this piece, and I didn't realize it until I performed it, that it's reaching so many different people, because it's the human condition of struggling to be okay with whoever you are, to struggling to be okay in your body, in your gender identity, sexual orientation, whatever's up for you. It's just that human condition of, like, am I really okay just being? Can I just be? And we're such a non-being culture, and thank God we're getting back to that. The paradigm is shifting. Be here now is a big part of my show.
Right.
Be here now. And I still am struggling with that. I'm 3.5 years into recovery, and every day is an adventure and a chore to just be okay with where I am and who I am and who I'm becoming.
There are so many stories of sexual abuse and recovery. And it makes me sad. I was watching the performance on the DVD, and it just makes me sad that every person who's going through this, on some level, has very similar struggles. And for each person, they're so hard. Even if you know what everybody else has gone through, you still have to go through the whole darn thing yourself.
Well, you know, I first started therapy in L.A., I went on a trip with my father, came back, and acted out in a big way, got in trouble, started therapy right away. And this is all included in the show. And I couldn't hear or see much at the time. I was just in a total daze, going to therapy 3 times a week. There was one little Robert Frost quote she had on her bulletin board, and it said, the only way out is through. And that made sense. Nothing else made sense. That made sense. And I go, then I need to just feel all this crap. I need to feel all this intensity that I've been hiding from, that I didn't even know was there. The intense rage, the sadness that never made sense. You know, I tried to always make sense of it. Like, is it because I grew up poor and isolated and marginalized? Or is it because I grew up gay in Virginia in a small town? Well, what's the reason I'm so rageful and I'm so sad? Finally, hello. I got messed with as a pre-verbal infant, you know, and so my whole life fell apart. But I trusted something, you know, universal presence, God, call it what you will. I didn't even have a real deep spirituality at the time, but I trusted something enough to know, yeah, the only way out is through. I have to go through this.
And you trusted these various therapists who, even when you didn't believe in yourself, they held out some hope for you.
Oh, yeah. And the beauty of it, my therapist, Shelley Pusich, in Los Angeles, she actually drove out from L.A. to see the first run in April.
Oh, that's
and that
so great.
Was, you know, that just felt like coming full circle. She didn't think I was going to live. I didn't want to live, but she really didn't think I was going to make it.
Would you, I don't know if you want to speak about the experience of getting into crack cocaine. I don't know many people who have done that, but it seemed like it was so easy to get into it and so dangerous in a very rapid, out-of-control way.
Oh, that's so true. Yeah, and this is all included in the show. I was doing therapy 3 times a week, like I said, with Shelley in L.A. Something about me and diapers as a baby came up, and I just blanked out, just went away. My whole body just said, we're not going there, and I shut down. And that night, I got online looking for sex. I'm a sex and love addict as well. Got online looking for that, and this is all included in the show. And not only did I find sex, found someone that wanted to act out a consensual rape scene. Never have done any of that in my life or been a part of that, and that felt like a fit at the time. Partook in that, and that night, you know, after 8 hours of nonsense, she offered me crack, and I didn't hesitate. And that's when I knew this is really crazy. I didn't hesitate because I was in that place of like, I can't do life. I just can't do it. I've tried my best to show up and be authentic and be a part of the planet, and it's not happening. The pain was too overwhelming.
I think it also brings a very important set of realizations to the whole phenomenon of drugs and people talking about how to deal with the drug problem and legalization and all these things. I mean, just the fact that when people get into a drug that harsh, they're really trying to get away from something, and that something, whether it be sexual abuse or poverty or all sorts of other social ills, is part of the bigger picture.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, they have a saying in recovery, you can go from Park Avenue to Park Bench, meaning you can be living the high life, and then you say yes to drugs, and you can just lose everything like that.
Well, I think the quote, the money amount quoted was $30,000 a month?
Yes, I happened, and this is a God thing, I think. This is a, you know, universal, something was holding me when I couldn't hold myself. The person I found online happened to be a trust fund baby.
Oh, my goodness.
Didn't have to work. She, you know, that was her income free a month from her dad's company, and I was getting high in the Hollywood Hills. I'm a crack addict in recovery. I've never been in a dumpster. I've never eaten out of a dumpster. I've never sold my body. I've never been in a crack house. That's really rare. It's really rare, and I get it now that I was being held, and I'm so grateful. I'm so blessed. It's amazing I can even form sentences, and I'm still sometimes I struggle with that. But you know, 6 months into my use, and I used every day, not all day, for a year and 3 months. I mean, we never ran out of it. She had Altoid 10 fulls. What am I trying to say? Altoid 10s full of the stuff. And insanity. And at like 6 months into my use, I couldn't, you know, mid-sentence, I'd be like, you know, we'd be processing all the time, my childhood or her childhood. You just talk nonstop on this drug. You just can't stop talking. We'd be up for days processing and processing. And I would, you know, I remember this one moment in particular because it was, I caught it and I thought it was insane, but we kept smoking anyway. I was like, oh my God, I totally get it. I don't remember the rest of the sentence. And that's exactly how I said it, but much faster.
Right.
It was like I had this epiphany, and then mid-sentence, I couldn't remember how to finish the sentence or what the epiphany was. And we both looked at each other like, this is getting kind of scary. And then we picked our pipes back up and said, right back at it. That's the reality of that drug. You can't put the pipe down until you do. Until you do.
We're talking to performance artist Kathleen Fontaine. Her one-woman show this weekend is called Learning to Stay at the Railyard Performance Center. What was your companion in crime, so to speak? What was she all about? Did you stay in touch? Did you go into your rehabilitation processes together, or did it push you apart?
We were evicted from the house she was renting. All of our stuff was put into public storage, big boxes. She continued smoking crack, and everything got auctioned off, so she lost everything. Her father, last I heard, had cut her off. She did end up going to Betty Ford, which was her, I think, fifth or sixth rehab facility. And I don't know. And then she went, I think she pretty much went right back out. I did talk to her shortly thereafter, but I cut off all ties. I did leave her thinking, you know, I was so idealistic, and it was really the drug talking. And it was also my sex and love addiction. Like, oh, we'll both get clean and sober. This is, we're meant to be together. We'll get clean and we'll work this out. You know, I honestly don't know if she's alive or dead. I hold good thoughts for her, and I hope she's on her healing path. That's the message, too, I want to say. This is a hopeful show. You know, it's not nitty-gritty. It's not going to leave people. I mean, you're going to feel your heart, and you're going to be opened up in a way that maybe you haven't been opened up in a while. But the message at the end, it just pulls it all together, and it's about hope and healing and possibility. Because when I crawled into Santa Fe, which I did, I didn't think hope was for me. I thought that was for rich people. I had everybody else but me could have hope. And now I'm walking every day into a hopeful future. And I have a hopeful present. I have a beautiful life.
Was there a moment when you knew that you were really out of the woods?
In terms of,
I'm not going to go back to drugs. I'm going to be okay.
You know, it's funny. My director's in town, like I said, from Baltimore. And we passed some place the other day on the road. And I can't remember what it's called. Concrete Jungle. She's like, what's that? I go, it's a smoke shop. I said, don't worry, I've never been in. But the addict in me stores where all the smoke shops in town are.
Right.
I know where they are, because if I need crack, well, I don't know where to get it in this town. But the addict in me, that's still cunning, baffling, and powerful, and very much alive, comes up and stores that information. It's like, oh, if things get too bad, I can go to one of those smoke shops and ask them where to get crack. That's, you know, I label it the addict in me. It's alive and well, but it's not as big as it used to be. My show's called Learning to Stay, because I finally learned to stay in myself, in my body, in my relationship with myself, with my partner, with my life here. I'm learning about integrity. I'm learning about that it's safe to be vulnerable. It's safe to be in my truth, whatever it is. You know, people that love me, they want that from me, you know? So sharing that with her, she was baffled, and she's like, what? I go, no, that's just the reality. If you're an addict, you know what's going on and where things, you know, if you drink, you know where every bar is. Maybe you don't go in them, but you're storing information for someday if you think you can't do it, if you can't do life on life's terms, if you can't, you know, if you just can't not deal with the pain. I really, when I first started the recovery, I considered it all pain management. You know, doing drugs was pain management, and then getting clean was pain management. It was just the flip side of it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, the second part being probably a lot harder and more conscious.
Way harder. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. I've been in treatment, been private practice with a therapist since I left rehab, and I was in rehab for 3 months. And so I've been working nonstop on my trauma work. I have found the best team here in Santa Fe, and I say, you know, if you come to Santa Fe and you want to heal and you can't, then you don't. You just don't want to, because there's every possible modality available here. Some of the most amazing...
Yeah, if you can afford them. I mean, it can run up a big bill.
True, true. A lot of people do trades, though, and I have, you know, I've been blessed in the other department.
I was thinking when watching your performance, that being a therapist, on the one hand, must be very fulfilling when your patient really does get better, and on the other hand, not a whole lot of fun during a lot of these crazy sessions that you depict in your show.
Talk about detachment. I mean, when Shelley, you know, sent me, when I made my way here to the Life Healing Center in Santa Fe, it was like she finally knew I might, there's a chance I'll live, because I'm getting some help finally. But that letting go, because you just never know what's going to happen with people. So there's a real lesson in detachment, I think, for them. I haven't asked them point blank, but yeah.
You're a performer. You've done stand-up comedy and radio and all sorts of things. How does doing this compare to the other kinds of performance you've done? I mean, obviously, it gave you the skills to do some of the real acting in it.
Yeah, I'm pretty much self-taught in terms of acting. I was always the class clown, you know. But stand-up, more so than sketch. Stand-up was really, I was working out some deep core issues with doing stand-up. I was standing on stage doing my stuff, which was very cerebral. A lot of crowds got it, a lot of crowds didn't. I couldn't have played comedy clubs. I never tried to. I did the whole art scene underground, you know. Stand-up for me was about being up on stage and on some level asking my, you know, asking the audience, asking the universe, is it okay that I'm here? Is it okay that I'm taking up space? Am I really funny? Is it okay that I'm alive? Because that was some deep stuff I was dealing with. And when they laugh, you know, when I had a good night, I'm like, oh, awesome, I deserve to be here. When I didn't have a good night, I was considering suicide. I mean, that literally showed me what I'm working with in terms of my own mental, you know.
Yeah, it's sort of like you're putting yourself in a position of getting conditional love.
Exactly. sketch comedy was more of a different thing. I'd worked with two other women, Susan Mealy being one of them, and then Serena Irwin. We were a sketch comedy group called Nude Coffee. We liken ourselves to In Living Color, but we were all white girls. We pushed the limits. We played everybody from blind people. I mean, just anybody and everybody. And the beauty of it was, I mean, we'd have blind people come to our shows and love it. Like, their friend would sit next to them and whisper what's happening, and they'd be roaring, laughing. And I loved the community aspect of what that was, theater and bringing people together and all of us laughing at humanity, not laughing at pointing fingers and laughing at somebody, laughing at the human condition. And I think that was part of what brought me into this.
And laughing at ourselves.
Exactly, laughing at ourselves. And this doesn't compare. This is something I never thought I would do. This is something I wasn't sure if I could do. Prior to the first run in April, I was like, really? Do people really want to come hear my story? Do I really have a story? Is it you know, worthy of an hour? Is it blah, blah, blah? You know, it's doing my normal spin. It is, and I can say that. I can say that. It touches people, and that's what I want to be about now. I want to give back. I want to let other people know there's hope. No matter what their situation is, if they're feeling like there's no hope, there's hope. And it's not just the Obama campaign. too late. That was a big part of it, too. But, I mean, there is hope, man. And I didn't know that. And I'm living it now. You know, I'm thriving. My whole life has been about surviving. I'm thriving for the first time in my life. And I'm soon to be 42. So I'm just blessed. And I'm really, really grateful.
Kathleen Fontaine is a performance artist. Her show this weekend is called Learning to Stay. It's at the Rail Yard Performance Center on Paseo de Peralta right here in Santa Fe. And it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, this September 11th, 12th, and 13th at 8 in the evening. For more information, you can call 946-0464. Kathleen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can hear us at my podcast site, which is santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz.